This weekend starts right after this.
How would you love a chance to save some money on car insurance? GEICO can help. Switch today and see all the ways you could save with great rates and discounts. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com to get a rate quote and get started seeing how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Don't be fooled. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
A former correspondent in Moscow says Russia's invasion of Ukraine is not about nationalism. It's about reliance on energy.
Being a flight attendant used to be a dream job, but now it's a nightmare. Hear about the passengers who make it that way.
Does exploring space travel make sense? A tech expert says no. He'll explain his reasoning.
And on the entertainment front, why it's too soon to dismiss romantic comedies.
Right now, they're targeting, they're trying to get to lure in traditional rom-com fans with the bells and whistles that rom-com fans always look for, you know, the sort of the fluffy, beautiful sets and the kind of fairy tale romances.
Ellen Gamerman at the Wall Street Journal with evidence that rom-coms are not dead. Well, Russian President Vladimir Putin has spelled out a nationalist rationale for his country's invasion of Ukraine, but it is primarily about protecting Moscow's energy interests. More from Lucas Albert, reporter at MarketWatch, former Moscow correspondent at the Wall Street Journal. Lucas, your take.
During the Soviet Union, when Ukraine and all the surrounding republics were really all kind of one country, you know, they built pipelines to bring Russian natural gas specifically to Europe to heat homes in Germany and Italy and various places. And those pipelines are still there. And there are two major ones. One runs through Belarus and the other runs through Ukraine. And that is really the issue here, is kind of control over Russia's access to market, basically, for their oil, for their gas products. It's a big source of revenue for the country. So what they're really concerned, what Vladimir Putin is really concerned about, if in fact, say, Ukraine were to join NATO, to join the European Union, is that he would lose control over this pipe, and that would put him at a disadvantage for pricing, for a variety of things. So that's a huge component of what the strategic calculus is here.
In the sub-headline of the story, you said, as towering skyscrapers rose in Moscow atop a pile of oil cash, Putin's government became more backward-looking and more isolated. Explain that.
Yeah, so, you know, I was a correspondent there from 2011 to 2014. And when I first arrived in 2011, Putin returned to the office of the presidency. He had been president for two terms, from 2000 to 2008. And then there was an intervening period where Dmitry Medvedev was the president for 4 years and Putin was the prime minister. In 2012, they sort of reversed roles, where, you know, Putin became president again. And, you know, during that 4 years when Medvedev was running things, the country had kind of gotten into a mode of, you know, trying to encourage foreign investment, you know, a little bit more engaged with the world from an economic standpoint. They saw some benefit to, you know, becoming more intertwined with the global financial system. When Putin came back in 2012 and into 2013, all of this started to reverse. You know, he had a different way of looking at this, and they became much more insular. The country became increasingly more isolated, feeling that they were not going to really do business with the West in the way that they had been sort of looking to do prior to. So, you know, and as time has gone on, you know, we've now, 2014, they seized the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine. They, you know, set up these sort of banana republics in regions in eastern Ukraine and sort of back a separatist movement there. And it's just been this onward lurch towards, you know, an isolationist kind of position, a separatist kind of mindset.
We're speaking with Lucas Albert, reporter at MarketWatch. He's written an opinion piece based on his years as a Moscow correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. It's called "Don't Let Vladimir Putin Fool You. Russia's War in Ukraine is Only About One Thing," and that one thing
is energy. It almost makes it seem like Mr. Putin then is operating on from a position of fear, like fear of losing power through oil or natural gas.
That's part of it. I mean, part of it is a kind of a somewhat nationalistic sentiment. He has said more than once that, you know, he views one of the biggest catastrophes of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, they lost their empire, essentially. And, you know, they had the whole Eastern Bloc, let's say, you know, they, not the, even the Soviet republics, but going all the way to West, you know, East Berlin. And, you know, all of that fell. And, you know, the Berlin Wall goes down and, you know, Poland, the Czech Republic, you know, all these countries, Hungary, all sort of lurching towards Europe. They become Europe. Many of them become members of the European Union. Some of them become members of NATO.
Yeah.
You know, when you get into the ex-Soviet republics, the proper ones, you have Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, which border Russia, you know, up towards the Baltic Sea. They become members of the EU and NATO, you know. And you know, so now their empire has moved 1,000 miles going east, you know, the border there. And that's how he views it. This was a huge loss of territory, of dominion, and you know, he thinks that they should have that back, or at least what, like, you know, maintain what they haven't already lost. So Ukraine is his line in the sand for that, on those purposes. But it also serves a serious issue for them from an economic standpoint.
How does this end, Lucas?
Or no,
how does it progress, I guess, maybe over the couple of weeks or months? Any thoughts?
I mean, it's anyone's guess. I mean, Putin is very hard to read. He always has been. You know, the general consensus is that, you know, they have troops now in these eastern regions that have been under separatist control for 7 or 8 years now, that they won't stop there. There'll be some pretext to, you know, kind of, you know, push further into Ukraine proper. Or, you know, the Ukrainian-controlled parts of Ukraine, and maybe take over the whole country.
Thanks, Lucas. Lucas Alpert, reporter at MarketWatch, and again, former Moscow correspondent at The Wall Street Journal. Coming up next, new guidelines for the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program.
This is a metaphor for your business's journey. Sometimes it feels like the world is throwing everything it has at you. And to succeed, you need someone to guide you through. That's what Dell Technologies Advisors do. They have the Windows PCs and tech advice to help you navigate whatever challenges you're up against and get you safely to where you want to be. Call an advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. A start to a simpler experience with Windows 11 Pro.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. A huge portion of the nation's workforce is employed in a job that now qualifies for loan forgiveness through the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. But many workers, including those who are not using their degree or were previously rejected for forgiveness, may not realize they are eligible. It's a story by Chris Quintana, national education reporter at USA Today. Chris, help us out.
Yeah, so you know, this is regarding the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, and it's administered by, you know, the Education Department, and the idea behind it is really simple, right? You work in a public service job for 10 years and you make payments on your loans, and at the end of those 10 years, whatever is kind of left on your debt would be forgiven, right? But in practice, it hadn't really worked out that way. There were a lot of kind of onerous requirements that prevented a lot of borrowers from accessing this forgiveness. So the federal government has revamped the program, and they kind of have a limited waiver in place right now that lets anyone who's worked in these public service jobs kind of benefit from it. So this is a time now where a lot of people who have been working in the public service sector and making payments on their loans may be you know, eligible and closer to debt relief than they realize.
Wow. Now, you said like hundreds of thousands of people, maybe more, could be eligible under this expansion?
Yeah. So this is kind of an interesting thing with the way that the government defines public service, right? When we think of public service, we may think of, you know, a teacher in an underserved classroom or a doctor in a rural area. And those are certainly examples of public service. But the way that this program works, it's based on your employer, and employers that qualify for public service are, you know, roughly government jobs, you know, local, state, or federal, but also nonprofits. And that's a huge sector of the workforce, right? So folks who had been employed in the sector full time over the, you know, since 2007, since when this program started, right, And if they have been making payments on their federal student loans, they are now eligible. You know, they've been eligible for this program, but the federal government has tweaked it such that they can get credit for their past payments in a way that they haven't been able to before.
Mm. We're speaking with Chris Quintana, national education correspondent at USA Today. His story is called Want Student Loan Forgiveness? Millions of jobs qualify for updated program, and yours might be one of them. I thought it was interesting, too, even if you've been previously rejected, right, you might as well reapply. Is that how it works?
Yeah, well, and so exactly. And I've spoken with borrowers both for this story and in prior stories, too, who had been making payments on their loans and who had heard of this program and they had applied and been rejected by the federal government because they didn't have like the right loan type, right? Or they were on the wrong income-based repayment program or there were a lot of different like small details where they could get tripped up. But now the federal government with this limited waiver is saying that, you know, if you had been rejected before, if you weren't on the right plan or whatever the case may be, the only thing that we care about at this point in time is if you were employed for a qualified employer and if you'd made payments. So this is, again, a huge opportunity for borrowers who are seeking forgiveness, who likely, you know, have been making these payments and could benefit from the program.
How do you figure out if you newly qualify?
That is the best place to do that is to go to the Education Department. The federal student aid site has a good will give you an overview of your loans and kind of what kind of loans they are and if they qualify for the program. And then you can also be reach out to your employer as well. They should be you have to certify your employment with your employer, right, to qualify for the program. So they should have a sense of if and how to qualify for the program.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting, too, in your story, you said, or somebody said, don't make assumptions about your career path or your degree.
That's right. Yeah. You know, the expensiveness of this program is really not to be underestimated. I mean, you could have whatever your degree is. It's not really important so long as you're like working in the public service sector. So, you know, someone, the creator of this job site was telling me, you know, you could be a doctor who's working at a librarian, at like a county library, right? And so it doesn't matter kind of what you're doing necessarily, it's just about who you're working for. And that's really what public service is about, at least based on the federal government's definition here.
And is there a window, Chris, for this expanded opportunity?
Yeah, so, you know, I'd been mentioning this sort of limited waiver, right? It was introduced in October of last year, and it goes through October 2022. But there are, you know, for borrowers who are interested, it may benefit them to start looking at that now. You know, for folks who don't have the right type of loans or who may need to go back and you know, seek proof that they had worked for a qualifying employer, you know, you may know it may take a while to do that, and consolidating loans can take a while too. So it is open through the October 2022, but again, these things take a while, and it may benefit borrowers to start looking at it now if they're interested.
That's Chris Quintana, national education reporter at USA Today. Coming up next, the airline passengers driving flight attendants to quit. If saving money is one of your top goals for 2022, then stop paying insane amounts of money every month for wireless. Switch to Mint Mobile. It's the easiest way to save this year. Since Mint Mobile is the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, they let you maximize your savings with plans starting at just $15 a month. At Mint Mobile, all plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and keep your same phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Choose the amount of monthly data that's right for you and stop paying for data you never use. They've eliminated the traditional costs of retail and you get the savings. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free, visit mintmobile.com/Gordon. That's mintmobile.com/Gordon. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/Gordon. Hey, glad you're with us. Pandemic anxiety, hostility, and tantrums have turned airplanes into battlefronts for flight attendants. In some ways, it's not so different on the ground for, say, greeters at big box stores. They all risk being cursed out, spit at, or punched. as they are asked to remind people to comply with mask policies. But Maggie Jones, contributing writer at the New York Times, says airlines are a particular dumping ground for stress and rudeness. Maggie, what are you hearing?
We seem to have lost our civility. I mean, it was a shocking story to report. I knew that flight attendants had it bad. I didn't know how many were being threatened and being punched and having really common unruly passenger issues on board, sometimes in flight where they can't get much help.
Jeez. You know what stood out to me, too, was that as you start chronicling some of these things, this is stuff that used to not be traced at all because it happens so infrequently, right? Now they have to track it because it happens all the time.
That's right. Up until 2021, they were not tracking them because, exactly as you say, there were so few of them. And now between 2021 into early 2022, there were like 6,300 incidents of unruly passengers in across airlines, and about 4,500 of those are mask related.
Well, I was going to ask, let's pick a random number, 100 incidents. 99 of those 100 are either tied to a mask defying passenger, booze, or both. Right.
Well, they only break it down by mask, but given that incidents of boozy misbehavior is up too.
Start with the story in which you opened your piece with this flight attendant. She's giving instructions. There's what appears to be a guide dog on board, right? And things just go south.
Yes. So she is pointing out, you know, exit signs, and there's a German Shepherd who the flight attendants are a little suspicious that it's not really a guide dog because it seems quite uncomfortable on the flight getting on. And she leans over, the dog and his owner are in the bulkhead row, and she leans over to point out an exit, as she does all the time, and the dog lunges for her.
Wow. We're speaking with Maggie Jones, contributing writer to the New York Times. Her story is called See the Worst People in the World. What also stood out is that I think it was one flight attendant you talked to. I think you used the name Roger in your story. He's filed like 30 complaints based on bad behavior, and they mostly go unaddressed.
They go totally unaddressed, according to Roger. And there was another flight attendant who said she's filed about 100 of them. And that is a big issue, and one that one of the major flight attendants union has called on airlines to address. That people actually, I talked to several flight attendants who weren't filing complaints anymore because, you know, it's the end of a long day. They usually have to do it once they get off board and on their own free time.
Boy, do flight attendants say privately that they can't wait until the mask mandates are lifted? So that's kind of one more thing they don't have to police.
Several of them said that they think it's going to make a big difference. And you know, but several of them, for their own safety, would like to have those mask mandates continue. But in terms of bad behavior, they think it will go down. But there are enough incidents that aren't about masks that I don't think this is totally going away. I think it's a part of a bigger cultural force that's been going on about sort of, you know, bad behavior sort of becoming more and more of the norm.
Yeah. So much so that there's, I think you said, a texting hotline for distressed flight attendants.
Yes, a flight attendant created it. It just went online in December, and they've had something like, you know, 5,000 texts back and forth. It's manned by flight attendants, and so they're trained in certain things. They do a lot of referring out, you know, to other services, but they've had people reporting feeling suicidal, depressed.
And people who fly infrequently may be thinking, oh, come on, you know, suck it up. It's just agitated passengers. But I mean, there was one, I think it was a woman, right? She almost got the hell beat out of her, for lack of a better term, right? She got three teeth chipped after multiple punches.
Yeah, the flight attendant asked the woman to put up her tray table, buckle her seatbelt, and pull her mask over her nose. And there's a video of it. She stands up and she just wallops her. I mean, yeah, I don't think you can just say this is these are one-off incidents. That's, you know, in the more extreme version, but there are several incidents of this, of flight attendants actually being punched or, you know, verbally threatened.
Thanks, Maggie. Maggie Jones, contributing writer at the New York Times. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. So I got to say, 2022 kind of feels like Groundhog Day. Wake up, read a headline about inflation, repeat, right? Inflation on the rise at the fastest pace in 40 years. But you don't need to check the price of organic eggs to know it's probably not the best time to put all your investment eggs in one basket. I'm talking about diversifying your portfolio. And thanks to today's sponsor, Masterworks, you can now add an exciting asset class to your portfolio, blue chip artwork. Masterworks is the new investing platform that lets everyone invest in contemporary art from icons like Picasso, Monet, and Warhol. In fact, early investors already have seen over 30% net annualized IRR in 2020 and 2021 from the sale of two paintings. No wonder the Wall Street Journal recently called the art market among the hottest markets on earth. Our listeners can join over 300,000 members and access their latest offerings at masterworks.art/Gordon. That's masterworks.art/Gordon. See important disclaimers at masterworks.io/disclaimer. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koshenka, final weekend of February. Here's what's coming up this half hour. Why commercial airspace travel is unlikely to scale up. Also, how caring for older relatives is so expensive. Plus, debunking the myth that rom-coms are dead. And how to help the people of Ukraine. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, putting people in space has made little sense for some time. So says tech analyst Rob Enderle. Writing for TechNewsWorld.com, he says the first astronauts, while well-trained pilots, were basically just passengers on a ballistic effort designed to make the Soviets look bad, and in retaliation for them making us look bad with Sputnik. He's got ideas about commercial space travel. Rob, how do you see this?
When we were doing, you know, international travel, you know, hundreds of years ago, we had a place to go that would support life. There was a reason to go there, and the environment would support the kinds of plants and animals that we would eat, and clearly there was air and water. There's no place off the planet Earth within any reasonable proximity that has any of those things. What space offers is raw materials, perhaps cheaper manufacturing of certain kinds of things like semiconductors. But the big problem, of course, is with heavy lift. In other words, what it costs you to lift heavy machinery into space, even that's not particularly viable until we can manufacture in space and actually mine in space and build things from what it is we mine. And the length of time it's going to take us to get there, we're going to have advanced robotics, and robots and machinery can hold up far better in space than we can. And, of course, we've got advancements in virtual reality, augmented reality. I mean, the way that we're exploring Mars today, to a large extent, is with robots and augmented reality, where researchers never have to leave the Earth, never even have to really leave their office.
Right.
And they can walk and explore Mars to their heart's content, using the videos captured by the various Mars rovers. The practicality of space travel until we actually have a place we can go within a lifetime seems unreasonable. And let's be clear, even if we were going to go to a distant planet, we would probably be far better off having a machine go to that far distant planet first and right. then create a virtual reality that emulated that planet and visit it virtually, as opposed to spending tens, if not hundreds of years trying to get to that remote location. So it doesn't make a ton of sense at the moment.
Okay, so that's a critical phrase you said, at the moment, because the headline of the piece says, why commercial space travel is unlikely to scale up. Did you mean ever, or just kind of not in our lifetime?
Well, no, I mean ever, because if you look at how we're advancing virtual technology and the ability to transfer our consciousness into machines, it looks like we'll have that done long before we will have figured out how the heck are you going to transport a human being across great distances in what is a very hostile environment to another place, which may either already be occupied by other things, be it illnesses we haven't seen yet, or other life forms that could be dangerous to us. It just looks like we would have better ways to expand our consciousness that are terrestrially based, as opposed to having to get in a spaceship and go tremendous differences. Obviously, this would change if we ever discovered intelligent alien life that came to visit us. But even in that area, we're speculating that that intelligent life is probably also using automated probes and not sending themselves out into space, because why? Yeah. The probes can capture and do pretty much everything that the organic organism might otherwise do. And if we're going to try to populate a planet, we would probably want to reconstruct our physical makeup to take advantage of what was unique at that planet. In other words, if we wanted to have people live on Mars, we probably would need to bioengineer them so that they could better survive on Mars without the massive amount of cost it would take to create underground bunkers effectively to live there. So they're just cheaper ways to do this, and robotics are advancing to a level that we could send an autonomous robot instead of a human, preserving the human life, and get a better work outcome, because the robot can work in that environment, as the rovers have showcased, where humans right now cannot do that well for long periods of time.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Enderle, founder and principal analyst at the Enderle Group. Coming up next, the unimaginable cost of caring for older loved ones.
This is a metaphor for your business's journey. Sometimes it feels like the course keeps changing right before your eyes. And in order to maneuver it, you need an expert by your side. That's what Dell Technologies Advisors do. They have the Windows PC and tech solutions you need to help you get out in front and stay ahead of the game. Call an advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. A start to a simpler experience with Windows 11 Pro.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Family caregivers are the backbone of the nation's long-term care system, often at great personal cost. For example, Amy Goyer is AARP's family and caregiving expert. She's written two books on the subject and has her own consulting business, yet Ms. Goyer depleted her savings and ended up relying on credit cards after being financially drained by costs related to caring for her parents. More from Claire Ansberry, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Claire, what has stood out?
What stood out to me was how the costs creep up, you know, and also that there's really kind of, I think reader or everybody kind of assumes that if you have that Medicare and Medicaid will take care of things, and that if you have long-term insurance, that will take care of everything. But there are just a lot of costs that keep creeping up. Long-term care, in-home care, all of these things are just creeping up. And that, in the moment, you do what is best for your parents, and that costs a lot.
Yeah.
And that it can even sort of get the best of an expert is just kind of sobering. This is a woman, and this woman, you know, as an expert, she knew all of the sort of support services that people look to, you know, the things like the Meals on Wheels, you know, the senior respite programs, the area agencies on aging, all of those supports that a lot of people are referred to. She knew those. She tapped those. But the costs are still huge.
Yeah. I have a little experience with this, but what struck me is that here's this woman caring for her father who had long-term care insurance,
yes,
a pension, plus, of course, Social Security, and that still wasn't enough to cover monthly expenses.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true. And, you know, one of the experts, a couple of them mentioned, they said, if you have long-term care insurance or your family member does, check out the policy because there are gaps in it. It's not, it covers everything, we're good. There are gaps in the, and there's specific things it will cover. There's time frames. You know, really don't assume that if you have a long-term care policy that it's going to cover everything. One of the things that, you know, Amy had mentioned that she wished she had known about or tried earlier was the VA benefits, which were great, but she wished she would have tapped into them sooner. So that helped too. But, you know, there are a lot of supports out there, but the costs are just rising so much. I mean, the annual cost of in-home care rose 18.5% in 4 years. And, you know, God knows what it's going to be in another 4 years. And I also think that, you know, a family member in that situation, their primary concern is the care for their parents. And this woman says, look, I made my choices and I own them. And I don't regret the care that I gave my parents.
Yeah.
And yes, she went through the humility, she was humbled by having to file bankruptcy, and it was embarrassing for her. But she said that, you know, she knows she gave her parents the best care she could.
Thanks, Claire. Claire Ansberry, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Coming up next, the rom-com revival. How would you love a chance to save some money on car insurance? GEICO can help. Switch today and see all the ways you could save with great rates and discounts. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com to get a rate quote and get started seeing how much you could save. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. On the entertainment front now, a run of experimental twists on the romantic comedy, along with the return of some big stars, have helped revive the genre. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Are rom-coms dead? Not so fast, says Hollywood. Here with the story, Ellen Gammerman of the Wall Street Journal. Ellen, are rom-coms making a comeback?
They are. The jury's out on how successful the big ones will be at the box office, like Marry Me.
We both did this. So whether we like it or not, we're in this together. We have to embrace the spontaneity of the moment. I don't want to be the punchline.
But there are a lot of Hollywood executives now trying to reinvent the genre a little bit with indie-style rom-coms or rom-coms with more diverse casts from more unusual points of view. So the rom-com, I think, is constantly declared dead, but it is always coming back in one form or another.
Who is the audience that they're targeting right now?
Right now, they're targeting, they're trying to get to lure in traditional rom-com fans with the bells and whistles that rom-com fans always look for, you know, the sort of the fluffy, beautiful sets and the kind of fairy tale romances. But they're also trying to reflect more the community that these movies are landing in. Judd Apatow, who did Knocked Up, is now a producer of Bros, which is going to be coming out later this year. It's the first major gay romance rom-com from a major studio really ever. And the whole cast, in terms of the principal roles, will be played by LGBTQ actors, including playing some of the heterosexual roles.
Ellen, what stars are coming back or making reappearances in rom-coms?
Well, Jennifer Lopez was back, and her movie did not blow the socks off the, you know, didn't blow the doors off the movie theaters, but it's also on Peacock, so it'll be streaming for a while. Sandra Bullock is a rom-com queen, and she had sworn off the genre about 13 years ago. But she, during the pandemic, she became really nostalgic for these movies. She had sworn them off because she felt like just the critics and certain parts of the public just treated the genre with such disdain and mockery. And she began to feel that same disdain for them as well, and for her own reasons. And now she's kind of coming around. She missed them a lot during the pandemic. She misses being able to laugh at a more lighthearted movie. And so she wants to, she's not sure what the unusual circumstances will be for her rom-com return, but she doesn't want like the classic young, white, privileged, straight story. She wants something with a twist. Maybe she says when she's 70 years old, she'll come back and do one as a grandma. But actually, more to the point, she does have a movie coming out next month, The Lost City.
Listen, Loretta, we need you to promote your new book on The Lost City. You can't spend your life in the bathtub drinking Chardonnay with ice.
That does have elements of rom-com in it, for sure.
We're speaking with Ellen Gamerman of The Wall Street Journal. Ellen, what's the challenge of making a movie that's both funny and dramatic?
I spoke with Judd Apatow about this, the filmmaker, and he made the point that a really good comedy is incredibly difficult for this reason. You have to make the stakes big enough and feel real enough and moving enough. You have to do a drama. So it's got to be a really compelling drama. Then on top of that, you've got to make sure that the jokes land. So you're kind of making two movies at once. And if you don't do a great job on either one, then you're left with a terrible movie.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Gamerman. Coming up next, how to help the people of Ukraine. We'll finish with this as news of the Russian invasion and its consequences for the Ukrainian people has spread. Many have watched in horror, feeling desperate to help. A handful of organizations are actively working to provide food, shelter, medical supplies, and support to affected civilians. Forbes.com put together some organizations to contact if you'd like to help. One is a nonprofit called United Help Ukraine. They distribute medical supplies, food, and donations to Ukrainian refugees and people on the ground in Ukraine, as well as offer support to Ukrainian families who have lost soldiers to war. Number two, USA for UNHCR. This is the United Nations Refugee Agency, which is accepting donations through a restricted fund to provide emergency aid to children, women, and men displaced by the violence. Number three, Voices of Children, a group that works to provide psychological and psychosocial support to Ukrainian children affected by conflict. Other groups include the Red Cross and the Kyiv Independent, Ukraine's English language media outlet. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.